Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight has dedicated much of his career to helping the most vulnerable people in our community. He is the son of Holocaust survivors who were determined to give their child a better life in Australia. And given that chance, he embraced the opportunities afforded to him and became a physician. He's passionate about social justice and harm reduction. And though now technically retired, he is currently an emeritus consultant at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney in their alcohol and drug service, among many, many other roles, which we will hear about tonight. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Alex Wodak AM to Great Australian Lives. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You have had an incredible life, which you are far more familiar with than I am, but I want to hear all about it. You've got a wonderful story to tell. As I mentioned, you are technically retired, but you're still consultant at St. Vincent's. You're the chair of Australia 21 think tank, director of Australian Tobacco Harm Reduction Association, an ambassador for Harm Reduction Australia, and a board member for the Australian Injecting and Illicit Drug Users League. So you're certainly not sitting back on the golf course, are you?
No, I'm not. And I feel that I've had a privileged life, and I feel that with privilege comes responsibility, and I've seen awful things that shouldn't ever happen. I've seen them happen and ruin people's lives, and it's hard, impossible for me to just sit back and do nothing, so I try and do something.
It's a wonderful trait to have, and you know, the people like you in our society, we certainly value. Now, why can you tell me why you are so passionate about this field of medicine in terms of harm reduction? And for those listening tonight, harm reduction means, well, let's get Dr. Alex Wodak to explain to us what harm reduction means.
Well, it really grew out of the HIV epidemic in the 1980s, and it was a desire to really focus on not just trying to eradicate drug use in Australia in the solar system, but to focus on what was achievable. And what was achievable was to keep HIV down among and from people who inject drugs, because the greatest risk to the average Australian, as in happened in many other countries around the world, the greatest risk was not HIV spreading among men who had sex with men, but HIV spreading among people who inject drugs, and starting from there and then spreading to the rest of the community. So I used to wake up at night terrified in that period. We didn't have any treatment. We didn't have prevention. And I really worried about what was going to happen. And so as it happened, I was working in the National HIV Epicentre, the Taylor Square, King's Cross area of eastern Sydney. Was the national epicentre of that epidemic. I had a chance to do something, and once I started thinking about it, I just couldn't stop myself. So I worked with a lot of other people, including, I have to say, people who injected drugs, and I learned so much from them. And it's really been, everything's really gone on from there.
We'll talk about that very bold movement that you were behind all that time ago a little bit later. But first of all, I want to understand from you, Doctor, sort of how you explain the philosophy of harm reduction, because there will, of course, be people in our audience tonight, and there are people throughout the community, many, who you know, are strong believers in prohibition, strong believers in sending the message of punishment, of incarceration, for people who use drugs. How can you explain how you explain to us the philosophy behind treating this as a health issue and you know, trying to move Australia towards a position of not punish, you know, not having prohibition for drug users. I've really talked my way through that. But...
Well, look, harm reduction is about focusing on reducing harm. It's about doing what's achievable rather than trying to create an ideal world, try and make the best of what we've got. It's about valuing the incremental gains. Very often when we're dealing with difficult situations and we want things to improve, some people have the idea that one or two heroic steps are going to be the answer to our needs. That's really the case. It's usually multiple small, tiny steps is the best we can do. And once you make one small step, making the next step is a little bit easier. It's about nothing about us without us. So it means that it's not just people sitting in gleaming skyscrapers on the 20th floor in air conditioning deciding how the world's going to work, but it's actually getting down in the street and working with people, working with vulnerable people who are struggling and learning from them. And often we do learn from them. It's about basing policy on evidence, but also basing policy on protecting human rights, because just because somebody uses an illegal drug doesn't mean they've lost their citizenship, doesn't mean that we shouldn't respect them. Of course we should. We must. So that's how all this really started. When we think about it, really we can see the same kind of policy has been adopted not just on this issue but on many other issues for a long, long time. In ancient China, they had a problem with people getting drunk in fierce midwinters, falling down the hill and ending up in icy canals and freezing to death. They couldn't stop people getting drunk, so they simply built barriers around the icy canals so that people didn't fall in. That's also harm reduction. The Americans 30, 40 years ago talked about making the world safe for drunks. Of course, we try to stop people being drunk and intoxicated in public, but we'll never achieve that completely. And the people who are drunk in public, we still have to protect them from being run over by trucks and semi-trailers. Mm-hmm. So we see this in many other walks of life. Promoting condom use is a way of reducing unwanted pregnancies, a way of reducing some but not all sexually transmitted infections, a way of reducing HIV. So these are all examples of harm reduction. You accept that there are going to be some behaviours you're not particularly happy with. They're going to continue. Those behaviours are going to continue, but you can prevent the terrible damage that they do. So car seat belts, airbags, motorcycle helmets are all part of the harm reduction approach. And actually, road safety is riddled with harm reduction, and that's a good thing. It helps us
reduce... Dr. Wodak, I want to interrupt you there and play the devil's advocate here. The listeners would probably be familiar with my story, and I will be transparent in that I have been a part of the campaign for harm reduction, given that my own sister died of a heroin overdose. So I want to be put that out on the table. But I do want to play the devil's advocate here and try and make this a balanced discussion. There will be people that will be listening tonight and people who say, well, you know, why should we accept those behaviours? Why should we say it's okay, you know, to consume illicit drugs? They are illegal. Follow the law. You know, why shouldn't we send a message, if you do that, you'll go to jail?
I'm sorry about your sister. We can't bring her back, unfortunately. But what we can do is we can try and prevent other families suffering as you and your family suffered from her loss. And we know that harm reduction does save many, many lives. Not only does it save many lives, it saves many hospital admissions, it saves many ambulance call-outs, it saves many precious healthcare dollars. Of course, the saving of life is paramount, but those things matter, those other things matter as well. And harm reduction also helps us to have more higher quality neighbourhoods. I went to Frankfurt 6 years ago and heard an amazing story there. So the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. The European Central Bank wanted to move its headquarters to Frankfurt, which is the business capital of the biggest economy in the European Union. But unfortunately, the area of the business area in Frankfurt, surrounded by a park, and there were an estimated 1,500 people injecting drugs in that park in broad daylight every day. And the European Central Bank said, we're not going to shift our headquarters to that kind of a neighbourhood. Sort this out and we'll shift the headquarters to Frankfurt. So the city council got together people who inject drugs, police, social workers, researchers, clinicians, all the usual suspects, got them together in a room and said, how do we sort this out? They came up with a package of recommendations which the council then implemented, and the problem of people injecting in that park didn't disappear 100%, but it almost disappeared. And the European Central Bank was happy, and if you go to Frankfurt today, you'll see a big gleaming skyscraper and a lot of high-paid employees in that building buying food and coffee and whatever from neighbouring shops. And the solution that they worked out worked for people who inject drugs and worked for people who don't inject drugs. So everyone won, and it was an example of harm reduction. I went to the centres that they built for people who inject drugs, and they're fabulous places. They're very supportive, non-judgmental, and they look after the people. And one of the things they do there in one of the centres I went to is they encourage people to get training in entry-level jobs. So they were training people in how to repair city park benches, how to repair wardrobes and tables that were left behind when an old person had died in their flat. So they taught people those skills, and then they could get jobs in the economy and go from there. So harm reductions is a terrific approach, and we adopted it as our national drug policy here in Australia on April the 2nd, 1985, when then Prime Minister Bob Hawke chaired a meeting of the six premiers and the chief minister of the Northern Territory. They all got together and all of them agreed that would be Australia's official national drug policy. So we try and reduce the supply of drugs, we try and reduce the demand for drugs, but we also try and reduce the harm from drugs. So it's a great policy.
Makes sense. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Alex Wodak AM, and more with him in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Dr. Alex Wodak, an international leader in harm reduction and whose career has been dedicated to the prevention of HIV, drug policy reform, and the prevention of drug and alcohol problems. Now, before we get into your early years, a little boy before he became a doctor, I do want to talk to you, Dr. Wodak. Just want to pick up where we left off in the first segment. We were talking about Australia's drug policy. Where does this country stand in comparison to others? I mean, I know that Canberra, as the capital, is more progressive than most of the states. But as a country, on a national level, we're lagging, are we not?
We were international leaders in the 1980s, 1990s. And we've unfortunately become laggards. We're lagging behind the rest of the world in many key areas that we really need to pick up. And an example of that is an $11 million inquiry into ICE and other illicit drugs in New South Wales 2.5 years ago, 109 recommendations. presented to the government, 5 recommendations rejected outright, and the other 104 recommendations haven't been dealt with.
Wow.
So that's an example of how politics is really not working in this area. The politics is difficult. But
can you tell me why? Can you explain the age-old question? Because politicians don't like going near this issue, despite the facts that are out there that you would know more better than anyone. Why not pick up that evidence from that inquiry and use it?
Well, it has a reputation of being a vote loser. But the Hawke government certainly enhanced its reputation by grabbing this issue with both hands and dealing with it very sensibly and making a lot of reforms that made a big difference. And look, Bob Carr needed a lot of persuading, I have to say, to accept that when he was Premier of New South Wales, to accept the medically supervised injecting centre in 1999. But then when he retired, he said it was one of the 10 best things he'd ever done. Daniel Andrews was also very reluctant to have a medically supervised injecting centre in North Richmond. And he also needed a lot of persuading, and eventually he accepted it. And then a year later, he gave a press conference where he said, "I was wrong. Every day this centre is open, it saves lives. And what we need is more centres." So he's convinced. And that's a very familiar pattern, that people start off instinctively in opposition to this area. They just wanted to go away. And really, we go back to President Nixon in 1971.
That was damaging.
Who's worried about not getting re-elected in 1972 because the Vietnam War was such a mess. So it was suggested to him by some of his advisors that he have a war on drugs. So he declares a war on drugs in June 1971. And really what the hope was that elderly, white and wealthy people would come out to vote for him in 72 because they would see this as a dog whistle against young, poor and black people. And that was, he liked that idea. So Ehrlichman, one of his advisors, was giving testimony on Capitol Hill after he came out of prison for his Watergate crimes. And he was asked whether the war on drugs works. And he said, "Look, it was only ever a political strategy. It was never meant to be a policy. Unfortunately, the people who came after me in the White House thought it was actually a policy, and it's not. It's just a strategy." And so it's true. It does often work as a strategy, as a political strategy.
But not on the streets.
Terrible failure as a policy.
If I want to talk about little Alex now, before you became a physician, before you became so well known on the streets of Sydney and around Australia, you were born in Melbourne as World War II came to an end, 10 days before the first nuclear bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, am I right?
Yes, that's right.
And your parents, they were from
Moravia, which is sort of a province of what was, when they were born, was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the beginning of the 20th century. And then it became Czechoslovakia, and now Moravia is part of the Czech Republic. My mother came from the capital of Moravia, Brno, and my father came from a little village about 80 kilometres away. And they fled Czechoslovakia because of they could see what was going to happen. They ended up in Singapore. And my father, who had trained as studied engineering at university, my mother had studied medicine, and they started working in Singapore. And then Pearl Harbor, they came to Australia with my eldest brother, who was born in Singapore. And then my middle brother and I were born in Melbourne. And then we went back to Singapore after the war, and then we came back to Australia because of race riots broke out in Singapore in the early 1950s, initially between the Europeans and the Chinese, and then between the Chinese and the Malays. So there were race riots, and I remember seeing those race riots. I remember looking over the balcony of our house and seeing a tank go past on the road, past our place, and I remember seeing people who'd been hurt and injured by the riots. So my parents thought that was no place to bring up a family, so we came back here. My mother, her medical degree wasn't recognised in Australia, her European degree, so she was forced to study again. And here she is in her 40s by now, three small sons, and studying in what for her was a foreign language, English. She spoke Czech and German and other languages, but English came later. So anyway, she managed all that, and she was an ardent feminist of a very peaceful kind, avoiding conflict and working around things rather than tackling them head on.
And your parents, Dr. Alex Wodak, were part of a sort of a very close network of Central European Jews, weren't they, who really wanted to give their kids a better life than they had had. So you really have had an upbringing that many Australians are just not familiar with at all.
Yes, they spoke other languages. They spoke English with strong accents. We had sort of smelly cheese on rye bread at home, which other people had sort of bread and Vegemite.
Sausages.
We had different kinds of food, and we used to get together on the weekends, and there'd always be passionate arguments and discussions about solving the world's problems. It was a very sort of engaged group, and they were very, very, my parents' network was very close and very supportive, and they made amazing sacrifices in their life because they were so grateful to be still alive, and they wanted their kids to have a better life. So they were unstinting in what they gave us.
And they did incredible things raising you boys. I mean, there's a barrister, a judge, and yourself, a physician. They must have been very proud of their sons.
Well, the important thing was to contribute to the community, not to have showy cars and possessions, but to take life seriously, make serious commitments, make serious contributions. So I think we tried to do that.
And that is something you absolutely have done in the Australian community, that is for sure. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Alex Wodak AM, and more with Dr. Alex in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Alex Wodak, who helped establish the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, the Australian Society of HIV Medicine, and the New South Wales Users AIDS Association. Doctor, we alluded earlier to your involvement and you being very much behind the needle syringe program in 1986. That was quite controversial, wasn't it? Can you take me through? This was Sydney 1986, and you had to resort to civil disobedience to make this happen, didn't you? Because the AIDS crisis was so bad.
The AIDS crisis was seeing this through the lens of COVID, as we probably do today. We can have some understanding how people were at their wits' end to know what to do about the HIV epidemic. Lots of young people were dying agonizing deaths, and there seemed no end to it. We had no treatment, no prevention. So we had to do something, and I group I was working with realised that the biggest threat was really from HIV spreading among and from people who inject drugs. So we had to do something quickly that was effective. And obviously the thing we had to do was provide people with clean needles and syringes and take the dirty used needles and syringes out of circulation. So I later discovered 13 submissions to the New South Wales Department of Health, which a colleague later discovered in the shelves somewhere. And I begged for permission to do this legally, officially, but I was always set aside, and I was working with a group of people, and we ended up on the 12th of November 1986, we went ahead anyway. And I was called into the health department. I was told to stop. The chief medical officer then whispered in my ear to keep going. So I did keep going. I was going to keep going anyway. And
what do you mean he whispered in your ear? Can you tell me what happened there?
Well, we were sitting around a table, and they told me I'd get into awful trouble if I didn't stop immediately, and I should call it all off. And I said I had no intention of doing that, and if I got into trouble, legal trouble, I would have no problem explaining why we were doing this to the people, and I was sure the people would take my side on that. And so the chief medical officer said, keep going. So
quietly,
we kept going, and then the detectives came to interview me, interviewed me for 45 minutes or so. I was enraged, and I quoted to them what was happening in New York City and in Connecticut and New Jersey and in Geneva and in Milan, and I had all these figures at the tips of my fingers. And at the end of the meeting, the leader of the police group said, we're not going to charge you, but the minister wanted us to interview you. So I knew that we'd won.
Yeah.
But a very difficult time for me. I wasn't used to that kind of confrontation. I realised I had to just extricate myself from this situation. So I took 3 months sabbatical leave, and I looked at the problem of HIV spreading among and from people who inject drugs in Switzerland, Netherlands and England, and Canada and the US. While I was in the United States, I ended up spending an evening in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, part of New York City, in what's called a shooting gallery. So shooting galleries aren't exclusive to the United States, but they're very much associated with the United States. So situation is usually minority people who are easy to distinguish, who have a hard time from the police, who search them in the streets and can easily find needles and syringes. So these characters hire a room, which is called a shooting gallery, and the owner of the shooting gallery, who pays off the police, provides the needles and syringes, which unfortunately are used. And this is one of the reasons the United States had such a shocking HIV record. So I spent an evening in a shooting gallery in Brooklyn, watching two men, two women, all Hispanic, spoke Spanish, no English. In the early part of the evening, I was really very angry with them for being irresponsible. I was worried about HIV and spreading among them. And by the end of the evening, I realized that really these people would have had such a different experience of life from my experience. They probably lived in squalor, no education, no decent housing, no employment. Their kids would have a similar life. Their grandkids would have a similar life. Very, very hard for them to break out of this. So I could understand why, even given those circumstances, they would want to have 2 hours of utopia rather than just having an endless life of misery.
Yeah.
So that was really a life-changing experience for me, and it made me really think about drug use in a very different way. And I was really starting to already realise that prohibition wasn't our friend, prohibition was our enemy, However well-intentioned it might have been, maybe, to start off with, the consequences of it were that it made every problem much worse.
Yep.
That we couldn't regulate the drugs. We had no control over anything that was going on. It was all run by a criminal black market. And it was a huge health, social and economic problem. And that was a very minority position to have in the 1980s. And these days, retired UN secretary generals and retired prime ministers and premiers and police chiefs often say the sorts of things that I was saying, and a few people like me were saying 40 years ago. And yeah. We are now starting to see those changes being introduced. But you asked before about how Australia compares with other countries. And one area where we clearly are in a terrible mess is our attitude to vaping, which is applying the principle of harm reduction to smoking, to tobacco. More deaths from smoking in Australia than from the combination of alcohol plus prescription drugs plus illicit drugs plus HIV plus road crashes plus suicide.
Wow.
It's a big issue. Here we have this invention of vaping in 2003. Not harmless, but more than 95% safer than smoking. And yet the entire health establishment in Australia is fiercely rejecting this. Now, I've been through this before with methadone treatment, needle syringe programs, drug consumption rooms, et cetera, et cetera. I've seen these battles before, and they always take that kind of form. When a new drug harm reduction intervention is, there's fierce resistance, but after a while people see the logic of it, then it gets introduced, and then people say, why didn't you tell us it was so fabulous? And that's what's going to happen with vaping in Australia. And we're seeing now severe restrictions that were introduced almost a year ago. What have they done? They've spawned a huge black market, which is now supplying young people, controversially. But the problem is the policy. It's the policy that spawned the black market. If we had sensibly regulated this, we wouldn't have these kind of problems. So this is a huge problem. Almost 8 million deaths a year from smoking worldwide, 1.1 billion people worldwide smoking. 20 years ago, there were 1.1 billion people smoking, still the same now. Australia's smoking rate is now going down slowly, 0.3% per year. But countries that have high vaping rates, UK, New Zealand, United States, the smoking rate is declining much faster than it is in Australia. And that means that in the future they'll have less cancer, heart and lung disease, and fewer smoking-related deaths. That's what this is all about. And it's also a big economic issue because smoking is very much concentrated in low-income, disadvantaged populations. And here we've had a sluggish wage growth for a decade. We've got a cost-of-living crisis now. And we've got the most expensive cigarettes in the world smoked by low-income people. So this, it doesn't make any sense. And sooner or later, vaping will be accepted and will be legal and regulated properly instead of this stupid policy we have, which has driven it underground.
Oh, so interesting how you see it go backwards before it goes forwards. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives, and we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Alex Wodak.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Dr. Alex Wodak. Doctor, I know that you have a beautiful wife, Jo, and a beautiful story of meeting her. She has been your companion 50 years.
Yes, that's true. We met on a boat going to India with Australian university students, and that was in 64. 65.
Is she hopeful? Sorry to interrupt, but is she hopeful, Dr. Wodak, that, well, was she hopeful when you said you were retiring that you might actually do that?
Well, we respect each other's independence.
you'd have to. You married that long.
We have very similar values, and so she is also a passionate fan of social justice, and she does a lot in that area. So she does a lot of volunteer work for street people.
For anyone listening, can you give us any words of wisdom if we want to stay married 50 years? What's the secret?
Well, I think it's important to respect each other's independence, but also to try and make sure that you select a mate who has similar values, similar interests, and we are fortunate to have that. We're very lucky. We've got four healthy, happy kids we see a fair bit of. So things have worked out in our family, but I'm very well aware, particularly through the work I've done over the years, that it's not always the same for other people. And we have to remember that some of the people, not all the people by any means, but some of the people who end up tormented by inner demons or tormented by memories of childhood abuse of different kinds end up on taking heroin and other similar drugs. And instead of trying to help these people and love these people and support these people, we think that punishing them is somehow the answer, and of course it never is. And we really need to change our policies around very rapidly, and it's difficult where the policies seem to work politically in the short term, even if they're a disaster in the long term.
Australia's got a way to go, hasn't it?
It does.
Now, what are you going to be doing for the rest of 2022, Doctor? Have you got plans? You're travelling to Europe? Oh, you are travelling to Europe, aren't you?
Yes, we go off in less than a month. We go to Europe, and we'll be indulging ourselves, going to... We both have an interest in classical music and in art, so we'll be doing that. And I'm hoping to see a 92-year-old friend in Geneva who's lost his gay man, lost his partner of 40 years or so from COVID. And John's had enough, and he's having his application to have exit. A Swiss organisation help him in that regard to check out. And so I hope to see John before that happens.
You're talking about euthanasia, obviously, in Switzerland.
Yes. And John played a very important role, John and his partner, but particularly John played a very important role in the global response to HIV. As a gay man, he understood that very well. And so right from the very earliest days of the epidemic, John was very involved in that. A wonderful human being, so I hope to say goodbye to him.
I wish you well. That will be a very emotional journey. I wish you well on that. And, Doctor, that is all we have time for this evening, but I'm so grateful for your time. It has been so informative tonight. I've loved hearing your story. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed our chat with Dr. Alex Wodak tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. And, of course, join me the same time next week for another episode of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.